All right, welcome everybody. My name is Sabine Mokri. I'm a China and the World postdoc fellow this academic year. And today we're gonna look at Taiwan elections in context. So as I'm sure everybody knows, about a month ago, William Lai Ching-te of the Democratic Progressive Party was elected president. And he and his new government, of course, face a lot of foreign policy challenges, but also domestic challenges, domestic concerns. So today we will take a look at those challenges and concerns. And we will do this with a few CIPA students who were actually there in Taiwan just briefly before the election. So Seamus Boyle and Roland Gila will present their observations and their and reflect on what they saw, what they discussed over there just before the election. And then Lucy Liu and Ayumi Teraoka will contextualize that a bit. Lucy will talk about how young people in Taiwan and in the PRC reacted to the elections and what this could mean for cross-strait relations. And Ayumi will also talk a bit about that and the broader implications that the elections might have on the Indo-Pacific and also on the what this means for the United States and its allies. So yeah, with that, I'll give the floor to you guys, and I'm really excited to hear what you observed and what you took from it.
So thank you to everybody for giving up your time to be here today. I'm excited to share with you some of the findings that our team was able to gather from the meetings and the places we visited in Taiwan. We were in Taiwan for about a week, and we were there through the final buildup, the last couple of campaign rallies held by each party, and we concluded with an election observation party and, some debriefing afterwards. But I haven't necessarily had the chance to share with anyone who wasn't on the trip my initial thoughts and feelings and what I believe are the biggest implications for the future of Taiwanese politics, as Sabina said, both domestically and internationally. One of the biggest goals I had, speaking of domestic versus international, with this trek was to help people who maybe don't have as much context for the domestic side of Taiwanese politics understand what Taiwanese domestic politics is like. Because, as is the case, I think, with many countries around the world, many democracies, the internal workings of their democracy, their election process, the major domestic political issues don't necessarily reach domestic audiences, let alone, American policy circles. So, one thing I wanted everyone to understand was not only is a Taiwanese election not 100% about China or about America, it can be about smaller issues. And some of the smaller issues during this campaign were major concerns like stagnating wages, skyrocketing house prices, brain drain amongst Taiwan's young population. But there were also smaller, pettier things like scandals over candidates' land ownership, supposed illegitimate children, just all the mud flinging and exciting drama of a full-hearted democratic election. So, among the major meetings we had, the two I'd like to highlight first were our brief meeting with Columbia alum, B. Kim Xiao, Xiao Meiqing, the vice president-elect. We met with her briefly on the campaign trail and got a sense of what it looks like when a Taiwanese candidate, or in this case, a VP candidate, is ferried around the island from major city to major city, doing what they call salsha in Taiwan, which is just when a candidate gets on the back of essentially a truck with a loudspeaker on it, and they drive around yelling at people on the street to get out and vote and get some face time. And we had it described to us by a DPP staffer as, there might just be one more undecided voter out there who doesn't know what they're going to do, has no real feelings towards any candidate, might just stay home. But if they see Bee Kim Hsiao screaming at them from a truck, they may think, oh, her, yeah, I'll remember her. So it can be something as little as that. Arguably, actually, in my opinion, what was easily the biggest takeaway for our trip and our team was the meeting we were able to have with former Taiwanese President Ma Ying-jeou, who was president of Taiwan from 2008 to 2016, and is a fairly controversial figure, to say the least, these days, especially. We met with him the day after he made some very controversial remarks to Deutsche Welle about how Taiwan, in its cross-strait negotiations, needs to, quote, trust Xi Jinping because they have no other choice. But it's interesting because when he spoke to us about it and when we asked him about it, and he very graciously answered, he said the phrase that Taiwan has no other choice, which is not what he said in his interview to DW. He said Taiwan has to trust Xi Jinping. And I think semantically, it's a very big difference. I think Ma, with his experience in cross-strait diplomacy and knowing the innate sort of asymmetry of any dialogue and of the diplomatic relationship, understands that there are certain things that Taiwan, if it wants to have cross-strait dialogue with the PRC, has to just deal with and has to accept, regardless of whether or not the current administration or other people are willing to accept those things. That remains to be seen. But I think all in all, in our discussion, Ma came across as a very measured politician, a very sort of lucid thinker. And although he put focus on some very strange issues, some very minor issues in the campaign, he also is very clearly someone who has principles in cross-strait relations, has principles about how Taiwan should interact with China, and is unwilling to waver from those. And regardless of whether we agreed, I think it's something I can respect, and I hope the team could respect as well. So we went to a number of campaign rallies. I personally went to the election night one for the Taiwan People's Party on Cataguilan Boulevard, which, if you're unfamiliar, is sort of the prime real estate for a political rally. Everyone is sort of fighting with one another to get Cataguilan Boulevard for their rally in the week before the election because it's right in front of the presidential office building. It's in the heart of downtown Taipei. It's very visible and it has some historical significance. It's historically been where people have gathered to stage protests, launch political movements. And so being there is a sign of your movement and your party's strength. If you can fill Cataguilan Boulevard, you're in a good space. And the TPP definitely did that on the night. When we went, it was virtually impossible to move, let alone get closer to the stage. It was something that I found a very, very humbling experience because my experience in Taiwanese politics has been, as most people's has, predominantly related to the two major parties, the DPP and the KMT. So to now have this third party who I think many people before the election, myself included, sort of dismissed as unserious, inexperienced, could actually get this amount of people together. And the whole time I was thinking, okay, the presidential candidate, being a former mayor of Taipei, maybe this is just, his home base, and he could only get this number of people because he's in Taipei, which is his home ground. But then the election results came in, and Ke did far better than anyone expected. I heard a stat from one of our lovely fellows just before the event started that he got over half of all people in the younger Democratic. What was it, 2018 to
20.
in the 20s? Yeah, which is fascinating. One of the things that our team did, which unfortunately I haven't included any pictures of, was we went to National Taiwan University, NTU, Taida, And we spoke to some outstanding undergraduates, but also master's and PhD students about their outlook on the election, because we wanted to get the firsthand account of young people who maybe are voting for the first time or just have more of a vested interest in the country's future and the policies of their leadership. And a lot of them expressed that they didn't actually care for Ke that much as a candidate, but what they really felt was just complete sort of indignation and just fatigue of the two major parties. There were people who in the past had been very strong supporters of both the DPP and the KMT, who, as they're about to graduate from undergrad and go out into the world, have realized that neither party over the last couple of times they've been in office has done as much, they feel, in their eyes, that that they could have been doing to make the country a better place for people entering the workforce, for people looking to buy a house. And instead have focused on these very macro level issues like cross-strait relations, like relations with the US, which, while inarguably very important, are not the kind of thing that an everyday person feels. Now, they feel things like the price of goods, they feel things like the value of their paycheck. And so if those things aren't being looked after by the ruling party, then sooner or later, the people will start to look for a third option. And I think that's what happened with this election. Going forward, it's very uncertain, I think, what the future of this third party will be. There was a lot of jostling recently to try and gather the, what's it look like, eight legislative yuan seats that the TPP got in order to try and elect a president of the legislative yuan. So as it stood, the KMT had 51 seats, I believe. The DPP had 50. And so if everyone voted along party lines, the KMT would be able to elect their own president of the legislative yuan, which is a powerful position, sort of akin to the US Speaker of the House. And the DPP felt that if they could poach the TPP, they could still, maintain a total grip on power. But the TPP decided stubbornly to run their own person, and in a, I think, very poetic lip, said that the DPP was the one who was ruining the race and handing it to the KMT by not voting for their candidate, which is what the DPP was naturally going to be saying. So it went as expected, and the KMT now has a major seat in government, as they've elected Han Kuo-yu, who some people may remember as their presidential candidate from 2020, as president of the legislative yuan. So even though the DPP won the presidential election, it wasn't a total victory like it's been in years past. They lost legislative representation. The KMT is now the biggest party in the LY, and the future of the Lai administration going forward risks including a lot of gridlock, and it's questionable as to whether or not he'll be able to pass the most partisan elements of his agenda. So while the domestic issues were a major part of what I wanted to impart on the team with organizing the trip, obviously the cross-strait relations are impossible to ignore. So our first meeting, actually, we went to the Straits Exchange Foundation, which is called Haijihui in Mandarin, and is Taipei's informal, unofficial body for conducting diplomacy with the PRC. The PRC has an equivalent on their side called the Association for Relations Across the Taiwan Strait, ARATS. And so whenever Taiwan and the PRC have conducted talks in the past, reached informal agreements, the conduct has been between SEF and ARATS. So we were able to speak to Dr. David Lee, who is the gentleman right by me to my left, and he's a fantastically decorated public servant. He was Minister of Foreign Affairs. He's been representative to Washington, to Brussels, to basically everywhere you can think of in the world that is important to have a good representative to. He's also been chair of the National Security Council. So our team having a diverse set of interests, a lot of us being ISP students, international security policy, but also some of us having a more generalist interest in cross-strait relations. We got to ask him questions about all different facets of his career. And he was able to impart some lessons on us about leadership and what it looks like to be a decision maker in government, and how sometimes, especially in Taiwanese government, where a lot of authority is delegated to the president, a lot of your responsibility as a public servant and an official is not necessary, is to know when it's not incumbent on you to make a decision and to support the ultimate decision maker in whatever choice they make. So we were very, very grateful to be able to have spoken to Dr. Lee. So I think reflecting on our trip as a whole, I would say the members of the trip were very sort of energetic in a way that I didn't expect them to be, and I was very pleasantly surprised by, and I'm very grateful to all of them for the energy that they put into learning about Taiwan and learning about its politics, but also into just asking their own questions, coming prepared with a curiosity that I think is hard to train in people, and really is the root of what we as an academic institution at Columbia and just people involved in academia in general can't really cultivate in people without it being there to some extent. And so, coming from Taiwan, having been born and raised there, I often wish people were more curious about Taiwan than they are. And I think I'm very fortunate that we were able to put together a team that had that curiosity. And thank you all for your willingness to come today and show some of that curiosity yourselves. I appreciate it just as much. Thank you. And I'll pass it over now to my colleague Roland, who performed some amazing, just self-driven research of his own while we were in Taiwan. And I'll leave that to him to introduce.
Thanks, Seamus. And really, thank you to the trip leaders who did an amazing job pulling this all together from scratch. And certainly for me, it restored my faith in the SIPA student body that they could do this pretty much single-handedly. So I decided to look at a different angle of Taiwan. My background is in emergency responses in conflict settings, and I thought it would be interesting to approach Taiwan in a situation before there's a crisis and see what the preparedness is. And so I set up a number of different meetings on the side, as well as attending the meetings we had for the elections. And the really interesting part of this is to look at what is the role that the politics plays in something that's quite technical around how do you protect civilians? How do you make sure everyone's safe? So I decided to look specifically at facilitating evacuations. I wanted to examine what was Taiwan's capacity to respond to a crisis by facilitating evacuations during conflict. This was building off of prior research I spent this past summer. I worked as an intern at US Indo-Pacific Command, where I focused on why and how they were able to get civilians to a place of safety in the war in Ukraine through negotiating humanitarian corridors and coordinating with local volunteers. And I believe that a lot of these lessons were applicable to future conflicts, and that was a goal of the research. In addition to the interviews that the team set up, I also conducted my own. I met with individuals at the National Fire Agency, the Emergency Operations Centers, the American Institute in Taiwan, and other government bodies who were responsible for both the high-level negotiations and the work with local communities. My main finding was that Taiwan has a very sophisticated structure for preparedness, particularly for disaster preparedness, but they're not ready for massively an evacuation, particularly in a conflict. And I believe this is because their planning is based off of four key assumptions, three of which have some problems. The first one that I heard repeated a number of times was that war will not last long. Emergency Operations Center officials, when asked where will people go when there is an aerial bombardment, they told me that they would go underground. And I said, okay, and then what then? And there is no plan. There's no plan for what happens. How will you provision them while they stay underground? There's no plan for how you provide them sanitation, and how do you get them out should that place become unlivable? Secondly, some of them would talk about how suburban areas would not be targets. When one of the things that Taiwan's done very well is that they have a requirement in their code, their building code, to have underground storage capacity that must be a certain number of times more than the number of people in that area. That means that you can keep people safe underground were something to happen. But they don't have that capacity in suburban areas, and that's based on the assumption that these won't be targeted. And I'm not sure that's a fair assessment. Most of the discussion focused around keeping people to shelter in place. But when they did talk about evacuation routes, there was also an assumption that these evacuation routes will be usable and you could move people around the island. Not only could these routes be blocked due to any kind of fighting or disaster, I think as well, there's a good chance that any mobilizing forces will also use those roads. And so it could be very challenging to then move civilians and to coordinate anything in an emergency setting. The last assumption that they had that was, I think, very good was that they talked about decentralizing civil protection. There was a real acceptance that the government is very competent, but it might face challenges that it can't overcome. And that's where the advantage of having a decentralized model with a lot of volunteers helps. So this is an overview of the emergency management system. It works on a central government level, a municipal, and then a township level. It's mostly coordinated by the National Fire Agency, which is both Taiwan's fire department, but it's also their version of FEMA. So it handles everything to do with emergency responses. And they have a central emergency operations center that coordinates the work with the police. It coordinates the work with the fire department and other departments that need to respond. You move down a level, there's an Office of Disaster Management, and they have emergency operations centers. And that happens even at the township level, where the onus is really on the local village leaders and community leaders to help coordinate these evacuations. The way they have it set up is that the police will be responsible for moving people and the fire department's responsible for finding them shelter. They have a plan. Then they also have the parallel system that they've really started to put in place in the last few years. A lot of this was building off of disasters that they faced in the last 15 years around responding to earthquakes and tsunamis. And what they've done is they've trained a number of volunteers. There are about 20,000 volunteer police and volunteer traffic police. And then there's about 40,000 volunteer firefighters, as well as emergency medical technicians and search and rescue personnel. Separately, they've begun an initiative that they're aiming for many more numbers, but it's about 22,000 of disaster relief volunteers, where people receive a certification and training, and there are different levels of that in order to be able to respond. And then they also work very closely with something called Suchi, which is a local organization that has particularly added benefit of working with the elderly. So there's this parallel system, I believe, will be very effective should the other system not function. And even if it is functioning, it examines the gaps that they faced in the past few years about trying to reach communities that are far away and having to make use of local knowledge that they didn't have access to in the past. When I discussed on-island evacuation, there was a lot of reticence. And I'm not sure whether this is because they didn't want to create panic or they really had not planned it. But the sense that I got from most of my conversations is that there was almost no planning of having to move people around the island. And I think we can all see what the risks are of a trapped population when there is some sort of conflict setting. So the two scenarios that came up were a movement towards the east of the island. The advantages are that it's less likely to be targeted. It's easier to move people off the island if you needed to from there, but it's also much harder to access and there's a limited capacity to keep people there. The second scenario was looking at moving people through up into the mountains along the central ridge, but these are very hard to access. This would create its own kinds of challenges. This is a little bit of a simplification given that there's quite a number of preparedness maps that they've put together, but they don't address conflict. My former colleagues at the Indo-Pacific Command put together an unclassified study looking at what it would look like to shelter in place. One of the things they came up with was that Taiwan has about a six-month stockpile in order to continue in those kinds of conditions. Most of that is making sure they have requirements of food and fertilizer, but then also how do you handle the energy requirements? Most of their electricity grid is handled by natural gas. That won't last very long. They have the ability to switch over to coal and to oil. And then ultimately, they could switch back to nuclear energy, of which one is still functional. But this is a political football. The DPP is very against the use of nuclear power. Categorically, everyone I spoke to said that they were not planning for off-island evacuation. I believe this is a true statement with regards to the civilian authorities who are not involved in this planning. And I believe that that creates challenges for the population if something were to happen. So this is a quick representation of where people might move to if you did need to move people off the island. But as of right now, many countries who might have to take them haven't had those discussions. The Philippines has raised the issue, but there haven't been a broader discussion of how you would address this. And I believe any effort to get people off the island would require some form of negotiation with the PRC. And that brings us back to this political football. The two statements that we saw contrasting, we met with a senior DPP official who said that any ability to negotiate with China on the protection of civilians was unreliable because compliance would be impossible. Contrast that with President Ma's statement to us, where he said that he would have to trust Xi Jinping. There is a mechanism in place. The Straits Exchange Foundation handles day-to-day service-level negotiations with the PRC. And so there is a relationship that you could build on if they wanted to, but that depends on whether there's political will. And to be honest, I'm not sure that that's something anyone would pursue or a crisis to take place. So this leaves us with a few unresolved issues based on the interviews that I was able to conduct. The first of these is civil-military coordination. The civilian authorities are largely cut out of discussions around evacuations and preparedness for conflict. That's a shame because they are very, very effective. And they have both sophisticated planning, but also technology, where they examine, they have sensors built up all around the island, and they can produce situational awareness within 5 minutes as to what's happening and how to reprioritize emergency teams. But they're not involved. So how can they be brought more into the conversation? And what can other countries like the US do to help encourage that, help training around that? As a follow-on from that, many of the civilian agencies have a problem with communications. They are very dependent on the communication system staying up, and there is there's not a clear expectation around redundancies. While I'm sure there are redundancies in place for other aspects of the response, this is one that is critical and is likely to go overlooked. Thirdly, it's examining water reserves and ensuring sanitation, particularly as populations move. And lastly is the challenges of coordination with large groups of volunteers. It's unclear who makes decisions, particularly at each level, particularly as people start to have challenges of communicating. And this is something that you even see bound to basic equipment. How do you ensure that teams are going to be safe if the volunteers are going in? They're not equipped to do this job properly. So in conclusion, I believe that the trip was very fruitful, and it was very a unique experience to see both how the political level can shape the measures in place to actually respond. And with the win of the DPP and perhaps a struggle to find common ground with China, it's more important than ever that they place greater attention to preparedness for any kind of crisis in the country. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus and Ronald, for your very interesting observations. And you all get the opportunity to ask questions in a bit. But first, let's hear from Lucy Liu. She's also a China and the World postdoc. And her research focuses on China's global influence in three international regimes, media, human rights, and foreign aid. And now she will give you a bit of a sense of how people on the mainland and also people in Taiwan saw the elections and what the results might mean for the future. Yeah.
Thank you so much for this warm introduction. And thank you so much for the wonderful presentations. As you can see, I didn't prepare slides, so I just come here to share my thoughts or observations on these elections. And I'm not a Taiwan expert by all means. I'm just a young scholar, grew up in China, had a really had observed the whole Taiwan culture from my personal interest, and had a lot of informal exchanges with friends from Taiwan. So it's great to share my observation on Taiwan identity in this election and how the younger generation kind of reflects their Taiwan identity and what that means to the cross-strait relations. So a majority of the younger generation in Taiwan would identify themselves as Taiwanese when it comes to issue of identity. They were born in Taiwan, and many of them speak Mandarin and Taiwanese Hakka. Yeah, and many of their grandparents did indeed come from mainland China, fleeing to Taiwan with Jiang Jieshi, in 1949, who lost in the civil war at that time with CCP. However, during Jiang Jieshi's rule, Taiwan was not considered an independent sovereignty and went through a period of long and horrifying authoritarianism with personality cults and brutal repression, now known as the White Terror. So later on, his son, Chiao Jingbo, especially his final years in office, started some reforms that gradually led Taiwan towards democratization in the late 1980s. That means the entire younger generation of Taiwan has grown up in a relatively healthy and robust democratized Taiwan. Unlike their grandparents, they don't have any collective memory of authoritarianism or fighting for China, so to speak. So many of them were kind of exposed to various fair played and contested democratic elections before they came of age. So that makes them really challenging to imagine an alternative that is not democracy, that is like giving up their voting power. So as they come of age, they're more accustomed to like expressing their hopes for Taiwan using their votes. And they're more used to making decisions for themselves through the ballot box. So over 70% of voters usually go out and vote in the presidential elections in Taiwan. So in this context, I think people care about Taiwan's story and Taiwan identity a lot. The polls show that not everyone thinks herself is Taiwanese or Taiwanese as their own identity, but a lot more young people try to identify that, and studies show that those people who identify themselves as solely Taiwanese tend to vote for DPP when the study was conducted. So according to the polls, DPP usually has a pretty strong base among voters before younger than 50s, and it is very attractive for voters in their 20s and 30s. And as we see in this election, DPP basically lost a majority of this space to TPP, a relatively young party founded by Ke Wen-je, and many of the younger people think it is a good alternative for Taiwan now, because they might see that DPP has a lot of problems as if it was the years as if it is pretty similar to Kuomintang in their minds. So another characteristic of this election is that all of those three presidential candidates are native-born Taiwanese. They don't have formal connections with China, as those politicians have little to do has little or no family ties or emotional connections to mainland China. Even if we speak about Hou Youyi, the KMT candidate, has no formal ties with mainland China, unlike previous KMT candidate who usually would possess a closer ties with China. So, and another figure that we are pretty familiar with up to now is the vice president-elect Xiao Meiqing. So her background and her political career including serving as Taiwan's ambassador to the United States, making her personally and professionally very close to Washington, D.C. So in Beijing's view, they may think she's a true independence advocate, and policies in Zhongnan had characterized her partnership with Lai Ching-te as du shao jia du, so meaning adding fuel to the independence movement. So politicians and supporters may emotionally feel that Taiwan would be closer to Washington, D.C. or even to Tokyo than to Beijing. I think that this part, in my opinion, would be a great concern that departs from the previous election that worries the mainland China a lot. So in contrast, this couple is quite popular in Taiwan. That's why they're elected, although they didn't have the majority of the popular vote. So when Xiao Meiqing joined the ticket, Taiwan people very welcomed her, this pair, and called them the virtue of Taiwan. So in social media, they talked about a pun that made out of the name, that is virtue, meide, and maid sound very similar. So people kind of embraced the identity of their Taiwanese, and this candidates also champion a lot about Taiwan identity in their campaign as well. So most importantly, I think voters would believe Xiao would help Taiwan to build a better relationship with the U.S. as she knows the U.S. Very well in the upcoming years. So today, I think the DPP no longer discusses the necessity of formal independence, while the KMT seems to process to have dialogue with Beijing, but underlines the 92 consensus and the voice topics related to unifications. So both parties seem to accept Taiwan's unique status quo, and the voters don't see that it is necessary to move a step further to express their identity as they have done in the past. So a lot of voters express that they are tired of the political rhetoric on the cross-strait issues, and they don't believe the vote would change the situation fundamentally. So that's probably why Ke Wen-je, who has little experience or ideological background in foreign policy, and his campaign strategy is primarily on domestic issues and inward focusing on the bread and butter issues, would attract most of the young voters. So moving forward, in terms of the implication of the election on the future of cross-strait relations, I think from the interest of the three actors, Beijing, US, and Taiwan, they would all love to maintain the status quo. First, I think Beijing is neither too upset, or it's neither too happy, but not too surprised about the election results or the prospects, since the DPP has already been an incumbent party for the past 8 years, as long as like does not deviate a lot from the current Tsai Ing-wen's policy, which he has talked about multiple times. He won't. Beijing seems to be fine with the current status quo at this moment. That said, I think as I pointed out, I think Beijing is quite concerned about the election, I think, but he remains quite profile in reacting to the election this time compared to the past. And he may be cautious of seeing a closer Taiwan with the U.S. moving forward for the reasons I laid out before. And second, as I just said, Taiwan's relatively younger generations have consolidated their Taiwanese identity in the past decades. They don't see an additional move to irritate Beijing for them to express their identity. So from bottom to the top, I think Taiwan doesn't seem to be too eager to push for changes. And also from the perspective of the US, it's better to maintain the status quo and avoid conflicts. Therefore, we shouldn't expect this election will change the situation dramatically. That said, Beijing may have already realized that the window for peaceful unification may have already closed when the ties with mainland China are vanishing in terms of political candidates in Taiwan, and then the expressed Taiwan's identity in this election, or perhaps moving forward, would be the main melody in this place. That's all I want to share. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucy. Let's now hear from Ayumi. She is a postdoctoral research scholar here at the Letterhead Institute, and her research focuses on coercive diplomacy, alliance politics in the Indo-Pacific, and Japanese foreign policy and national security. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to hear a bit more about the implications for the region and also here for our relations to the US.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me to this panel. Again, I am not a Taiwan election specialist, but I do study Taiwan in the context of U.S. alliance politics and Japanese foreign policy. So how I will just share how Japan has been observing this election and what's the implication for the future of Japan's defense policymaking. So Japan has observed this election closely, just as any countries did. There were a group of lawmakers who are already in Taiwan the day of election to be the first foreign guest to congratulate Lai and Tsai Ing-wen for DPP victory. And then the perception might be because of this 8 years of really good relationship with Taiwan, people might think that Japan was kind of aiming for, looking for a victory by DPP. But that's only a simplification. I think that Japan has supported Taiwan for the past 8 years, and then Taiwan-Japan has been developing their ties, boosting their ties, but also came T candidates and TPP candidates who are in Taiwan, and they were sending the same message of strong Taiwan-Japan relationship during their candidacy for presidency. And I think because Lai Ching-te was able to give assurances to Japan that he will continue Tsai's direction of foreign policy, that's what Japan supported. So, of course, Japan will say officially that Japan will work with whoever is elected by the Taiwanese people. But I think because of that assurance that Tsai Ing-wen's direction of foreign policy will continue, Japan, of course, is happy that DPP was elected. I think there's a lot more confusing signals coming from TPP or KMT, just because, as previous presentations have noted, you know, saying like we should trust Xi Jinping is not a very popular phrase or shared by many people in Japan. Of course, there is a minority of people who still say that, like former Prime Minister Hatoyama, but you know, he's not longer a popular figure in Japanese politics. So Japan was happy to see how the election was conducted, despite all the election interventions. You know, it was done fairly safely, and you know, people were able to express their views and vote for the candidate that they believe is right for the presidency. But I think whoever is elected, and what the situation with the twisted sort of UN situation and difficulty in democratic decision making in at the parliament, I think Japan would have to continue to work with Taiwan and sort of think about contingency planning and how Japan can also strengthen Taiwan's resilient democratic resiliency in the face of increasing pressures coming from mainland. And just to kind of overview the recent years of Japan-Taiwan relationship, the relationship could not be better. And societal ties have always been strong, but have even been stronger over the last 8 years. And one of the sort of recent example is we had a Noto Peninsula earthquake on January 1st this year. And within 2 weeks, Taiwanese people donated 2.5 billion yen. And those sort of donations coming from Taiwanese people are noted and sort of celebrated or portrayed in media as a really good signal coming from Taiwan. So Tsai Ing-wen government has been really doing well in terms of sort of winning hearts and minds of Japanese people. I think it kind of hits really soft spot of Japanese when we think about how to think about future of Taiwan and not separate Taiwan's well-being from ours. Political ties have been strengthening. Taiwan is now a popular destination for many Japanese lawmakers, like just like for U.S. lawmakers also. Governor Koike of Tokyo Metropolitan Government was just in Taiwan last week. Aso, the vice president of LDP, who's no longer in the executive, the government, but still sort of the second highest position of LDP, went to Taiwan last summer, Hagiuda, who's very close to Abe, is now currently a policy council chairman of LDP, also went to Taiwan in October. So those visits are kind of indicate that it's now popular for Japanese lawmakers to show kind of connection and support for Taiwan. And then rumor was that the former Prime Minister Abe was going to visit Taiwan now that he was no longer Prime Minister and he got assassinated. But this sort of tragic assassination also offered an opportunity for Japan to invite Lai Ching-te as a BP. And that set a precedent for future visits for possibly Bi Kim-xiao as a BP to visit Japan. And of course, Tsai Ing-wen is already being invited to visit Japan after stepping down from the office. So there's a lot of calls for sort of high-level exchange and visits. And I don't think that Beijing has reacted so fiercely recently about each visit, but maybe they will going forward. I'm not sure. And then I think one of the recent development in Japanese politics is that this Abe faction that was led by Abe, the biggest force within the LDP, is now sort of being really weakened amidst political funding scandals. And then people might think that is a kind of damage to Taiwan-Japan relationship because they should represent sort of biggest voice for pro-Taiwan stance. But I think that's not really true. I think the people outside of that faction within LDP or outside of LDP have supported or shown support for Taiwan. A lot of opposition party members are also visiting Taiwan. So it's I think this support for Taiwan, democracy and sort of strength and resilience in the face of Beijing pressure is shared among political spectrums. There is a lot of homework for Japan to do as it thinks about Taiwan's security and sort of realization that came to fore that Taiwan's security is not really indivisible from Japanese security. One is sort of to boost Taiwan's economic well-being. Japan and Taiwan already have really strong economic ties, but one of the new phenomena, as you know, is a semiconductor collaboration. So TSMC has already is opening the first factory in Kyushu this year. They already decided to open another one in Japan. So that's one area of cooperation. Taiwan has always expressed interest in joining CPTPP, which was originally 12 countries, including US TPP, and then US left, became 11 countries, and now Britain joined, so it's now back to 12. But now we have a precedent of new membership. So Taiwan has already expressed interest, Japan has already expressed support for that, but at the same time, China has also expressed interest in CPTPP, and I think people have not yet expressed how we will deal with these new membership interests in the CPTPP. But that's one way that Japan, without United States, could take leadership in terms of giving Taiwan more voice or fora internationally. The last and biggest homework is the military ties. Japan and Taiwan barely have a sort of official defense cooperation. The only thing we have is we have a Japanese retired self-defense force official stationed in Japan's representative office in Taiwan. That person has been stationing since 2003, and that was the position was created after reflection by the Japanese government that we really don't have any intelligence or connection with Taiwan during the third Taiwan Strait crisis in 1990s. So that started in 2003. Last spring, Japan added another personnel who is an incumbent Minister of Defense official to station in Taiwan. That person is already there. We have two personnel. And I think the next discussion is, do we actually need an active self-defense force officer to be there? I think that this already new personnel added to Japan's representative office is already important because if they are officially having positions within Ministry of Defense, they have more access to information and intelligence under new security law imposed to civilian officials in Japan also. So I think having more official ties is sort of inevitable in some ways when those actors are going to do more intelligence sharing that is needed for future planning of the military. But I think the U.S. involvement in the connecting those two is will continue to be important. That said, I think that one of the challenge will be about the twisted UN. But I think these defense cooperation doesn't always necessarily require legislation. So I think what happens in the future, in the next years, is that Japan or U.S. will try to strengthen their ties with Taiwan without going through UN or in areas that doesn't require sort of involvement of legislation of UN, if that complicates the prospect of deepening ties with Taiwan.
All right, thank you very much, Yumi, and thank you everybody for sharing your thoughts and comments. I would like now to open up the floor for questions, and we will do it in this way. So you will ask a question and I will repeat the question so that the people who are joining us online can also hear it, because we need to keep our mics here. So yeah, I already saw two hands. So yeah, let's start here and then go over there.
I think two other key results of the LY switch will be investigations specific on things like submarines and vaccines. And also, I expect Honorable Yu to put much less emphasis on parliamentary exchanges with Europe. You mentioned all the young supporters of the TPP. If you had a chance to interact with them, I don't know, but if you talk to any of those young supporters, how did they rationalize or get past Colin Joe's penchant for very inappropriate remarks, specifically of a homophobic and misogynistic nature? Because I know how socially progressive Taiwan society is, so seeing him there just doesn't add up for me. Any insight you have, greatly appreciate. Thank you.
So the question is how the young people in Taiwan, who tend to be quite socially progressive, but at the same time, the TPP candidate had some not very progressive remarks, and how they kind of get around that. What did you, what was your impression of that? I think you can use this one here.
So if I had to say, the biggest factor, I think, is Ke as a politician has a lot of things explained away for him by the fact that he proclaims to have Asperger's. And so he is sort of given a pass for a lot of the things he says by, you know, the people who come out to defend him, saying he can't help it. You know, if you take the frankness that he has about institutions and norms in politics that people welcome as a breath of fresh air, you also have to take the sort of weird, offensive, invasive thoughts that he sometimes spouts. You have to take the good with the bad, regardless of whether or not I feel like that's an acceptable calculation to make. I'm not sure. I haven't really thought about it. But he definitely gets his speech explained away for him by a lot of different people.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's continue with the questions. Yeah, Maya. Okay, so the question is how, since both South Korea and Taiwan were colonized by Japan, how this affects or how the what explains the changes in how persistent this is in collective memory? Yeah.
Thank you for your question. I think that a lot of people get puzzled by the contrast. And I think there's many good scholarship on this, including Inang Ku's work on historical memory and how the discourse over the experience of Imperial Japan and occupation of Taiwan has been sort of being discussed in Taiwanese narrative, on Taiwanese discourse. And I think a couple of reasons, but one contrast between Koreans' experience and Taiwanese experience is that Taiwan, compared to Korea, Taiwan had less strong national identity when Japan occupied. So that was one difference, that, you know, Koreans already had really strong identity that they felt that they were violated by the Japanese imperial army and imperial control by the Japanese. The second difference is, of course, is Taiwanese experience with mainlanders coming to Taiwan. And there's a lot of atrocities that were also committed by mainlanders. So as they people in Taiwan experience various types of people who occupy the Taiwan, they have different sort of reflection points to compare Japanese occupation. And I think there are various other reasons. Maybe we had Japanese had better leaders to manage occupation of Taiwan than Korea. So various reasons can explain that. But I think the contrast actually makes Taiwan stand out as a neighboring country, neighboring actors or countries or regions in East Asia to be very pro-Taiwan. And that, again, hits really soft spot of Japanese when we struggle to reconcile over historical legacy with Koreans and Chinese. So at least continuously, Japan was able to continue really strong affinity toward Taiwan because Japanese people also feel strong affinity from Taiwanese to Japan. So it's kind of mutual.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Hi, my name is John. I'm a first year at the law school. I also lived on Taiwan for 2 years. The question I was very curious about was kind of like based off the emergency response, but you know, if any of you know any like kind of plans for getting the veterans of the Taiwanese draft program or any like even private military like resistance groups into operation as a deterrence when a possible invasion might happen.
Right. So John wants to know more about what would happen if there was an invasion and how the different groups that are being drafted or that are being trained would really get into action. Any insights on that?
So I do know that there is an effort to bring veterans in emergency response capacities, given that many of them already have the kinds of training that you are trying to bring to these disaster relief volunteers. So there is an effort to bring them in, but it's not a deterrence effort. It's really to maximize the response capability. As to whether they are involved in national defense, I don't know. I did meet while I was over there some individuals who were involved as civilian volunteers in Ukraine, and we're beginning to share some of the knowledge between Ukraine and Taiwan at a very hyper grassroots level. But I don't know the extent to which they're mobilizing that on the defense side.
I might also add that civilian defense has become a more popular sort of commercial good in recent years. There have been two organizations in particular that try and train just ordinary civilians to provide things like basic medical assurance, you know, apply a tourniquet, clean a gun, find clean water, and that kind of thing. Just overall civilian preparedness, which is building on President Tsai's overall defense concept from her first administration, but also, you know, being seized on by a couple of fairly high-profile DPP legislators. One of them, Enoch Wu, who has a foundation called Forward Alliance, Zhongkou Taiwan, and another one by a legislator named Puma Shen, Shen Boyang, called Heixiong Xue Yun. I don't recall what it is in English, but they both are civilian defense institutions that anyone can just pay for, take classes, and in theory, you're brought up to a certain standard that would allow you to look after fellow civilians during a crisis.
Okay, thank you. Are there more questions from the audience? Yes.
I have a question for Yumi. So I guess the elephant in the room when it comes to Japanese military say cooperation or involvement in a potential Taiwanese crisis or conflict is Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. So I guess my two-part question is, A, would that provision allow U.S. forces to utilize Japanese bases during such a crisis? And B, if Japan were to
decide to get involved militarily in a more outward manner, would that require an amendment to the constitutional provision, and where is that going?
Okay, so the question is about Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution and whether that would allow the United States to use bases in Japan during a crisis over Taiwan, and more generally what this means, what this article means for Japan's general ability to be active there, and whether that would an amendment would be necessary.
Thank you for your question. I think a simple answer to your question is Article 9 wouldn't affect Japan's involvement if the situation calls for Japan's self-defense and also collective self-defense in situations where Japan's security and survival are strongly influenced. So if Beijing uses force to invade Taiwan, and if they don't attack any of the US bases in Japan, that would probably make it more difficult for Japan to be involved. But even so, I think the interpretations can be made that even that situation impacts survival and security of Japanese people, and therefore Japan can use force or defense military tools to be involved. There's a lot of restrictions still on the use of force, but it really depends on how lawmakers at the time would determine the situation to be. So there are various criteria that Japanese government set up in 2015. So whether the situation is considered as survival situation, a threatening situation, armed attack situation, or important influence operation or situation, would all kind of change the range of actions that Japan can take. But at the very least, Japan will likely help the situation by defending themselves, by using their own bases and capacity to defend themselves, will restrict Beijing's, complicate Beijing's military operation in Taiwan Strait. And as soon as US bases in Japan are hit, and would likely then involve Japanese national safety and security and probably lives and casualties. And that will quickly become a Japan's security issues. So that will then become a self-defense issues, not collective self-defense, which is already allowed, but maybe it's really a self-defense issues then. So answer is no. Thanks.
Thank you. Next question, please. All the way. Yeah, so the question is about whether an escalation of or a conflict will lead to would lead companies and other governments to divest from Taiwan. And I think one of the most, as you said, one of the most important areas is, of course, the semiconductor industry. Maybe we can, it would be really interesting to see what you learned about that, and maybe also the semiconductor industry a bit more generally, because it's so important.
Absolutely. So we spoke as our final meeting to the Vice President of International Operations at UMC, United Microelectronic Corporation. It was a man named Mr. Ling Wuguo, or Guo Lingwu, who is a former national security advisor on a former senior advisor on the National Security Council to President Tsai. And so he gave us this very detailed breakdown of Taiwan's place in the international semiconductor supply chain, and essentially said that it is impossible for Taiwan's role in the chip supply chain to be duplicated anywhere else. Because beyond any of the technical hardware that exists within like TSMC or USMC or UMC foundries, beyond any of the, you know, special capabilities, special organizational structures that exist in those companies, it's the technical expertise of Taiwanese personnel that has been built up through the decade plus of a first mover advantage that Taiwan has had since the late 70s, early 80s, that allows Taiwan to maintain its distance from the rest of the world in producing high-end chips. Now, Mr. Guo also pointed out that high-end chips are not the only chips that exist in the world. In fact, most of the world's trailing edge chips come from China, and China has this great capacity to produce quote-unquote less sophisticated chips at a far greater scale than Taiwan does. So while there are people who point out that TSMC and its ability to produce bleeding edge, cutting edge chips, whatever you want to call them, is a major point of leverage for Taiwan, China also isn't completely absent of leverage in that field either. So while U.S. interventions in the area, like the CHIPS Act, their export restrictions and partnerships with the Netherlands and Japan against China, are attempting to curb China's ability to catch a company like TSMC, China, just by sheer force of its mass, I think will always be a relevant player in the chip space. So I don't think any U.S. attempt to fundamentally reshape the nature of the chip supply chains globally is going to bear any fruit, certainly in the next couple of years. I think Taiwan will always remain too critical a player, barring some drastic meltdown. And yeah, China will as well, but in a different way.
The only thing I'd add, I believe, well, I wonder how much this kind of move, as you describe in Vietnam, is more tied to wanting to address potential blockages or interruptions in the supply chain. One of the things that we learned while we were over there was that 12 to 15% of the power in Taiwan goes towards TSMC. So in any scenario where you have challenges bringing in any of the required fuel supplies, you're going to see a interruption in the work of the semiconductors. And so I wouldn't see this as a kind of long-term change in the market, but rather a short-term, how do we make up for what could be a very severe interruption in any period of time? That would be my question.
Great, thank you. Are there any more questions in the audience?
A lot of Congress people in the United States, representatives, senators, don't seem to understand how TSMC works, and they see TSMC as a prize for the mainland to seize in an attack on Taiwan. They say Taiwan's security is at great risk because the mainland can seize Taiwan and thereby seize TSMC and thereby quickly make the entire world dependent on China for high-end chips. And what they don't understand is that TSMC is really a convener of technologies. It is not the owner of the technologies. And that what they've done is they've created a great production capacity for bringing technologies from outside of Taiwan into Taiwan to produce the actual chip. So it's the fabrication plants that are the most important. They're very good at it. It's very high tech. I'm not taking anything away from Taiwan. But if there were a conflict across the strait, even if it were a blockade, let alone an invasion, it's almost certain that the most important inputs into TSMC would be cut off entirely. And TSMC would remain the leader in chip production for maybe a couple of months. And the mainland would be left with a shell. And that's the nature of transnational production. That's the nature of modern economics. But it's not the case in Washington, which I visit often, that people fully understand this. And a blockade against Taiwan would cut off TSMC. It would cut off the mainland from chips from TSMC, which would be bad for the mainland, but it would almost certainly cut off the inputs into TSMC. And the entire world would be affected. There is a report by the Rhodium Group that has been made public that talks about the trillions of dollars of damage that would be done to the world economy by a mainland blockade of Taiwan, simply because TSMC would be taken offline. And that, I think more and more countries around the world are concerned about Taiwan's security because they realize this.
Yeah, if I might second that, I think the chip dimension of Taiwan's security and cross-strait security is sometimes, or actually often, overblown. China wanted Taiwan before TSMC existed. They would want it if it vanished tomorrow. So, you know, a cherry on top, maybe, but it's not, as Professor Christensen says, it's not just a matter of like plug and play with semiconductors. It's IP that's sent to the foundry that is really the core of TSMC's model. And, you know, beyond that, I really think that American policymakers tend to conflate the chip issue with like any other kind of natural resource, whereas, you know, previous invasions in the past, arguably, yes, have been for natural resources, but you kind of see resource wars growing less and less common as we get into this globalized world. So I think it's very important for us, but also lawmakers, to understand the historical dimension to China's desire to annex Taiwan, the cultural dimension, the, you know, the other facets of the security dimension, all these other different motivations beyond just, you know, the fact that they have some machines that make small chips of silicon better than other places.
The logic is backwards. In other words, the mainland has all these reasons that Seamus laid out so well to care about Taiwan, to worry about Taiwan independence, to try to tell that. An attack, the use of military force to quote unquote solve that problem from their perspective. The TSMC piece would be a cost, not a benefit. Mm-hmm. In other words, they would know that they were cutting off TSMC from Silicon Valley. They would know that TSMC was no longer going to be as functional, and they would know that they themselves would not be able to import TSMC's products as they do in large amounts. So they would have to calculate that on the cost side, whereas in Washington, it's treated as an added benefit for attacking Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly 180 degrees back.
All right, maybe as a final question, did you come across any expectations that were formulated for people, lawmakers in the United States, as in what people in Taiwan expect from people and politicians here?
Yeah, so when we spoke to students at NTU, the first thing they had for us was, what do you think is going to happen in your election in November? So if Donald Trump gets back in, then I think all bets are off again. I think his Taiwan policy is uniquely incoherent. I think he's extremely anti-China, but at the same time doesn't understand the Taiwan issue at all. I think he's, like has been reported in, I think, John Bolton's book, how he described, you know, the Resolute Desk to China and Taiwan to this pen, and Taiwan's like a chip that I can use against China. He doesn't understand how his stance is like very welcome to Beijing. He doesn't understand how the US president not understanding why he needs to support Taiwan is very, very enticing to leadership in Beijing. They love the fact, I would guess, that Trump doesn't understand his historical commitments based on his office and the US's historical commitments to Taiwan. I think having this sort of chaotic actor who is unaware of how to act beholden to the policy that came before him and doesn't understand how to honor the commitments made by his predecessors to Taiwan, I think Beijing absolutely loves that scenario, even though the flip side of it is, you know, bluster in the trade world against China and anti-Chinese policies and all other realms of society, I think, on the Taiwan issue. Obviously, there's institutions and staff that he'll bring with him that will prevent him from doing anything too silly, knock on wood, about Taiwan. But I think the rhetoric that he's shown between the end of his administration and today on Taiwan has gotten progressively more worrisome. He's a strangely popular figure in Taiwan just because he dislikes China so much. And And because he has done like a couple small things, or like he had a phone call with President Tsai when she was elected. Well, no, when he was elected, he took her call on Air Force One. And then just
before he was
right. And then he has, you know, all the trade moves, being willing to put more Marines at AIT, all these cumulative things just have made him a sort of semi-cult figure. Although, again, like Ko and Zha, everyone understands why on paper they're not supposed to like him. But there is the sort of fact that Taiwanese people, because we are so starved in a way for international recognition and attention, if there's anyone who's willing to take Taiwan's side, even in a superficial, ignorant sort of way, Taiwanese people will take it.
I'd say one other expectation I heard a lot of was, will the U.S. respond if something happens to us? Which I think, as Seamus put very eloquently, we don't know, and we can't know until at least the next election. But one thing that I said from learning from what happened in Ukraine was the fact that the U.S. didn't start to become heavily involved in supporting the government in Kyiv until after they had repelled the attack in Kyiv and they started to make some successes. And so I believe that it's likely the U.S. would respond and support Taiwan so long as the Taiwanese people were still willing to resist, to which a lot of the people we spoke to, and especially the students, said, well, we think that the Taiwanese people are willing to resist as long as we expect the U.S. will respond. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and a very challenging conundrum to get out of, and I don't have the answers to that.
Maybe one more question? Yeah, sure.
And when he was, the day he was selected, asked, he was responsible.
Okay, so now we're looking ahead a bit to the day of the inauguration in May. And the question is, first, how the new president can or should talk about independence and what this might mean, or how Beijing might react to such rhetoric. And the other question is about people from outside coming, so foreign leaders, foreign guests coming, and what that, how this might be viewed in Beijing. So, Seamus and Lucy, what do you think? Maybe
can I just take the first shot, and then you just correct me if it's true. So I think my first hunch is that Lai would not go too wild, because he mentioned a couple of times that he will follow Taiwan's policy, and also he's a very experienced politician, right? So he's not as young or inexperienced as Ke. So I think that he understands that what he says would mean a lot, and then the Beijing would watch very closely. So even though he himself really wants to, he might want to take a bolder move, but like his advisees, I guess, would kind of keep that in check, hopefully. So I also heard a really good metaphor on this situation is that the DPP, so now the DPP and China are like, so now Taiwan and China are like driving on the highways. DPP wants to cross to another line, so he doesn't want to go too closely with China, but the KMT thinks it's okay to be like in peril with China, and then they can drive together. But they don't know whether in the future they will like cross with each other. But like, for DPP, even though it really wants to go to the exit of the highway, it's kind of blocked. So the exit is kind of blocked by the U.S. or by a lot of factors. So I think this is a quite interesting analogy to think about the situation, is that perhaps the status quo is like the DPP would just like drive not too closely and not too far away with China, but they still don't know whether, but they don't see this is their best interest to irritate Beijing.
Yeah, thank you. I would agree. I don't think Lai is in a place where he's going to be able to change Beijing's mind about him as a politician. I think Beijing's mind has been made up for a long time about him. Even though he has moderated his stance on Taiwanese independence in recent years in order to become electable, he had to become a little bit more moderate. The infamous image of him holding up the sign that says "Long live Taiwan independence," the practical Taiwan independence worker quote, and then he had another quote about how, no matter what position I end up in politics, I will always, love Taiwan independence and work for it. You can't really get rid of those. He said those things, he did those things. So just because he comes out and says a slightly different thing, or I mean, to be fair, it is a very important distinction, but if he does present his different stance, Beijing isn't going to buy it. They didn't buy it with Tsai, because Tsai, back in the 90s, helped Li Denghui produce the two-state theory. So she was also, stamped by Beijing very early in her career as an independence, activist. So I don't think it'll be extremely necessary for him to restate the phrase, Taiwan's already independent, we don't have a need to declare it. He might phrase it in a different way. I just think he's on record in a number of different places saying that his record as an extension, his commitment to be an extension of Tsai is pretty clear at this point. So I don't think independence is an issue that he's going to center at all in his administration, just because if you look at polling data, this has been consistent for as long as polling has been collected on the independence issue. The desire for immediate de jure independence has always been in the single digits. So the fact that, the idea that a president would talk about it is not really in anyone's mind, even if it is, even President Tsai, for example, wasn't constantly talking about the idea of we're already independent, we don't need to declare. In fact, I don't think it was like a central part of her initial campaign. It was something that came along once she was already the incumbent. I think it was most highly centered in a BBC interview a couple years into her presidency. So it's not something that I think Lai will focus on too heavily.
I can say something. The phrase that Taiwan is an independent state has been stated by both KMP and DPP politicians, including Ma Ying-jeou. Just that the way it's stated is that Taiwan is already a sovereign independent state called the Republic of China. And it's that last piece that bridges the gap between the KMT and the DPP, because they say the Republic of China existed since 1911, before the PRC even existed. And it's a sovereign state, and it has all the trappings of a sovereign state. All Taiwan politicians have to say that, because everybody in Taiwan believes in sovereignty. They just have different definitions of what sovereignty is. What Lai Ching-te did once before the election was just say Taiwan is an independent state without saying Republic of China. But he's returned to the Republic of China language that was consistent with Ma Ying-jeou and Tsai Ing-wen. And now in his acceptance speech, he said that he would handle cross-straits relations in a way that's consistent with the constitution of the Republic of China. That is as accommodating a position as any Taiwan politician can make of any color, blue or green, in the current environment in Taiwan. So if he continues along that line, that should be seen as encouraging. On Tsai Ing-wen being dismissed, it's interesting. I've been talking to mainlander experts, and I kind of pressed them on this, because they said we have to dismiss Tsai Ing-wen because she's really pro-independence. We can't deal with her. But they're willing to admit now that they're even more worried about Lai. So apparently there are degrees of dismissibility. So suddenly Tsai looks like a moderate to them because they have an alternative, which looks even worse. And many Americans have been pressing this argument that Tsai has been extremely moderate and extremely strategic and extremely stabilizing, and that she might be missed. It's generally taken as an encouraging sign that President-elect Lai or Vice President Lai has said that he's going to keep with the Tsai Ing-wen line on cross-strait relations.
Absolutely. I think just one final point to add about the idea of independence as the ROC. Something that I thought Lai did very well during one of the presidential debates was he said to Ke and Ho, his two opponents, he said, if you're going to call me in favor of Taiwanese independence, then you're in favor of Taiwanese independence too, because you're not running for governor of Taiwan. You're not running for special executive of Taiwan. You're running for president of Taiwan. And so that means you too are, you know, implicitly recognize the idea of our sovereignty. And so you're pro-independence too.
All right. So thank you, everyone, for your sharing your thoughts, reflections, and comments on the elections and what a day may mean. And thank you, everybody, for coming in such a great number. It's great to see there's interest in the topic. And I see Daniel getting us, has gotten us dinner. And so please stick around and help yourselves to some dinner. And yeah, thank you for your questions. And see you next time, I guess.